Maybe.
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 Hello, Francine and Jeff. This is Nan.
Man.
Hello, Nan.
How you doing?
Oh, man.
Good. What's happening with your work week?
I'm in Virginia, and I should have brought my computer, but I didn't, so I'm on my cell phone.
Ah.
Yeah. And I'm hanging out, looking at Peter Brown's website, reading about, let's see, the yoga. That was the last thing I was reading about.
What did it say?
And I found myself at lunch with coworkers talking about non-causality and is it possible that none of this really is what we think it is? I'm like, oh man, I better
Uh-oh.
dial in the night sky tonight.
Really? Cat's out of the bag. Now they know that you're strange.
Oh yeah.
I can just hear him now whispering by the water fountain, "Hey, what's up with Nan?"
Yep. Gets weirder all the time.
Yeah. I mean, she's nice and all, but that stuff that she's talking about is freaking me out.
I figured I better skip dinner, just be dinner with them, just because, like, you know, I'd rather kind of talk about it to somebody that actually maybe doesn't, I don't know, is more open to it.
I find I need a couple of reality fixes throughout the day. Otherwise, this muggle shit starts to creep up on me.
You know what, though? There's a tendency to turn this into a philosophy, and there's a tendency to, I guess, use just the words almost as a
Yeah.
defense against the vulnerability of just, you know, the boredom or the other stuff. And that's not what this is about. It's not about a philosophy. It's not about a belief system.
No,
And yet it
no.
does help to get some review of the words. Like on Peter's website, he talks about words and,
Right.
you know, he says they just don't mean what, like the words don't get it. They're not it.
Yes, it's almost nauseating to discover that what's actually appearing in your experience is untainted by the stories that we tell about it. I mean, really, if it goes, colloquially speaking, all the way home or all the way down, the observation of reality is strong enough to destroy completely one's sense of self. Which is a little dangerous, you know? It's like walking around with a lit stick of dynamite.
You know what I've been noticing is that my sort of attempts at manipulation of what this is, they don't do a friggin' thing.
No, that's right. No one is listening to
No, they're not. And I'm actually
you.
finding it quite relaxing to just set that down. I'm finding it like kind of pleasant.
Here's the greatest ecstasy a human can know, the discovery that you are a puppet.
Yeah.
It really is.
Well, not only.
It's the greatest ecstasy. So, hang on a sec. We have a loud phone call. He's making all that racket. I don't know where that's coming from. Suzanne, maybe? Yeah, so what were we saying?
It's that to discover that you're a puppet. To like
Yes.
realize you don't have any control over what is going on.
Yeah, the greatest ecstasy is the discovery that this is occurring all by itself and that You are truly a puppet.
Wow.
Yeah, but it's also that same revelation is also the thing that we resist with the most conscious and unconscious fervor.
Yeah.
Same revelation, you know, go to the left or go to the right.
Well, it sounds fine when things are going well for you. You know, if things are cooperating and smooth, then that's not an issue. But if they're not cooperating and don't seem to be smooth, then it's holy shit, give me a handle on this. Give me a way to manipulate it to get what I want.
Well, that's the, the reflex to turn dials and hope that they're connected to something is based on a continued association with creaturehood. So as long as one's revelation or elation is contingent upon circumstances, then it's clear you're still a creature.
It seems like the compulsion to grab those dials fades in proportion to lack of investment in self.
Yes, indeed. And lack of investment in self is, you could say, an outcome, a consequence of a deepening appreciation for what is actually occurring in reality. Because you become swarmed, not by bees, but by elation. And as you're swarmed by elation as a puppet, then the investment in things being or turning out a certain way changes profoundly, immeasurably. And then we're no longer invested in grabbing dials or turning them so that the circumstances of my life can be pleasing or appeasing.
The desire to work the system is kind of fading.
Yeah, that would make sense.
And I still seem to ride the bike.
No problem. You know, Brahman is wearing you like a sweater, and you know, you don't get off the bike until Brahman steps off the bike.
Yep.
You can't do anything about the entire apparatus and profundity of experiencing, or what we call what appears so-called after birth and before death. You can't do anything about it. Or
That's
you can just sit.
Friggin' relaxing.
Yeah, it can be really, really relaxing. Oh my God, there's nothing to do about this.
Yeah.
But we can also appreciate, you know, not to be cavalier, that, you know, if you stopped being continent or went spontaneously blind, or, you know, something that you really relied upon, right, to get through a day, just broke down.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we could appreciate the panic and the disorientation that would set in. Because look how urgently we insist upon knowing what's happening and what's happening to me. And how aggressive we are with our senses, right, with seeing and tasting and touching and hearing and the mind, to insist that we know what's going on and what's going on with me. And if any of those sense windows are interfered with, we become remarkably, profoundly frightened and irritable instantaneously. Because the identification with the creature is so powerful.
But isn't that frightening, the fear and the irritability, that's all part of the show. You're still being played like a puppet.
Yes, yes. All that appears, all and everything that appears is, you know, it's you're being played. Yeah. I mean, we are not in charge of or responsible for the degree to which we are identified with the biological strata or our wardrobe.
Yeah.
life or our life savings, or the frightening lack of life savings?
Or the ability to see this and perhaps see through this, we aren't in control of that any more than anything else.
No, the fact that you find yourself interested in cosmic discoveries is something you simply could not avoid.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, most of the people you know, socially or otherwise, familiarly, in the workplace, most of them, I would dare say, are not interested in discovering a goddamn thing about the cosmicity of your present experience.
Yep.
They don't give a shit. They don't care. It's not even on their radar. But you, you're insane. You're insatiable.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
screw
you know,
dinner. I want to go to Target and buy a charger so I can hang out on my cell phone and talk to you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. And so the insatiability to play with and discover and unwind, penetrate the profundity of consciousness is something that, you know, you can't take any credit for.
No.
Yep. This, whatever Brahman is, and Brahman refers to all that is, you know, the emptiness and the profundity prior to, behind, responsible for all that is, right? The unbroken unicity of the sacred Godhead of the... Whatever that is, it is wearing you like a sweater. And that, once it's seen with the profundity that's capable of being seen, one is released from, you could say, all identification with creaturehood. And then you are the happiest fucker on the block. Hey, that's why, you know, any card-carrying seeker flocks to, you know, a teacher, right? Call it a guru, call it a mentor, you know, call it someone that is either realized or pretends to be realized in a convincing manner. Right? Because our instinct is to get as cozy as we possibly can with the miracle of puppetry and be the happiest fucker on the block.
Sign me up.
Yeah, sign me up. That's right.
Happiest non-fucker on the block.
Yep, you can call it that as well, of course. Yeah. And as painful as it may be, you know, and confusing as it may be, irritating as it may be, to participate in the discovery and the adventure of self-reflection and self-revelation, you know, it's a kick. It really is a kick.
There's something attractive about other seeming individuals that are up to the same shit.
Yes. Yeah. You know, if you're into chess, then you know where to go to play chess.
Yep.
Right? If you're into vegan potluck, you know where to go to participate in vegan potluck.
Yep.
If you're into ruination, you figure out who to hang out with to celebrate ruination. You find your tribe, right?
Yep. What is it about this increasing ability to just sit and stare?
Yeah, well, you know, that could be referred to as yogic immersion. Or it could be referred to, depending on the discipline, as a rigpa or stream entry. You know, I don't know what the Sufis would call it. Some, sure they have a word for it, right?
It's so just so always here, and you don't have to do anything, and it's heavenly not to do anything.
Yes, it is curious to discover that your fundamental nature happens to be heaven. Yep. If you start to discover, you know, either abruptly or a little bit at a time, that your fundamental nature happens to be heaven, then you'd be an idiot not to sit around and stare. There's no crime in the observation that heaven happens to be really fond of itself.
Pretty full. It's like dense. Sitting in a room, it's almost like the air around and inside the room is just dense, like super dense. Like, how the hell do you even see through this? It's so present.
Yeah. It's uncanny, the degree of subtlety and call it hallucinatory revelation that can occur as you find yourself relaxing and relaxing and relaxing into, you know, netherness. Because, I mean, look at the primacy or the primality of what is creating the observable sensual universe. I mean, where do you even start, right? Where? Molecules, elements, earth, biosphere, gaiosphere, galaxy, cluster, where do you even begin? I mean, you know, your adrenal glands. I mean, they're magical. Every single spark and whisper of animate and inanimate conglomeration is dense with unspeakable beatitude and sensorial wonder. And as your nervous system, call it that, even though it's subtler than that, right? As your nervous system attunes to its own radiant miracle, which is both the expressive side of the radiant miracle and the reflective side of the radiant miracle.
Tawid.
What's that?
That's the Sufi word for...
What's their word?
Tawid.
And how is that defined?
It says making one unification or affirming the oneness of God is the central concept. I don't know if it equates, but
yeah, no, it's close enough. I mean, if we smoke a doobie, everything starts to fit.
And fana means annihilation, so
there you go. Yeah. So I mean, any culture that you go to, even if it's high altitude paganistic shamanic cultures, you know, you're going to find curious and marvelous vocabulary that refers to the immersive sensorial otherness of revelation. Yeah, the, you know, the unity consciousness experience.
Yeah.
I mean, you could make a fine point on it and say, oh, anything that is appearing in experience is not true. You know, but that's crap. Whatever this is right now, whether it's being felt by you as, you know, a way to waste time on a Tuesday evening or something other than that, is the entirety of reality. This is that reality. So it's silly to say that we can't speak about it. We can't refer to it. We can't delight in it. You know, that's like sophomoric. Here it is. What's wrong with saying, oh my God, this is God. This is the consciousness, the warp and the woof, the fullness, the emptiness, the form, the rigpa, the taurud of the entirety of being right here, right now, just as it is. Why pretend that there's something other than this that is, you know, somehow unspeakable? That's absurd. It's stupid. It makes people think that their present experience is somehow, you know, a malignancy rather than a divinity. Even if your present experience, let's say, sucks, for whatever reasons it appears to suck, it is still, right, the apogee of divinity. It may be experienced in a melancholic manner, but, you know, still, you're Jesus, you're Buddha, you're Brahman. This is it. Ta-da!
I think everybody's actually had the experience of, you might say, like, divine suffering. Like, there's somehow, there's a sensuousness to it, almost.
Yeah,
like,
yes.
Especially, I tend to like the drama piece.
Right. Yeah. It is. I mean, there's a certain lusciousness or sensuousness to the profundity of experiencing.
I look back on times that I have suffered, or my stories about times that I have suffered, and
yeah.
It's almost like I'm playing the suffering heroine of a movie.
Yes, right.
It's kind of fun.
Yeah, there is a certain kind of fun. I mean, you know, being shamed because we are conditioned to seek approval, attention, and validation. As much as it hurts, you know, it's part of the weirdness of the way we relate with life and with each other. You know, all of these kind of frivolous vulnerabilities that we carry around, or the ways that we are injured or injure others, so-called, at a psychiatric or emotional level, is just part of the bizarre lusciousness of life, right? Of the primate way to roll. You know, it won't be long now before we all absolutely choke to death from deoxygenation. It's just right around the corner, you know. Humans are going down. It's not likely a wormhole to another world is going to show up anytime soon, and our mishandling of the vitality of the biosphere is, you know, accelerating. So this, we may as well party. I mean, really, if someone said, hey, you know, I'm going to give you 30 years to live, right? If someone says, hey, the rest of your life is all you've got left, what are you going to do? The rest of your life is all you've got left. You go, oh, you mean the rest of my life is all I've got left? And they go, yeah. You go, fuck, I'm just going to party, man. What are we holding out for? What the hell kind of future are we holding out for so that partying today doesn't make sense?
Very loud.
You may as well party. You're going to die. The whole species is going down. I mean, we should all be partying.
I'm too loud.
Instead of, you know, killing each other.
Definitely feels more and more like a dystopian, futuristic society.
It sure does. Yeah. It sure does. Yeah. I mean, we all get excited by, you know, the next zombie attack, whether it's artificial intelligence or, you know, giant ice calving that'll drown everyone, or God knows what it is, you know. I mean, there's so many interesting threats for that. So many, really. There's just an orgy, right? An orgy of imminent threats for the species. You can get really, you know, hot, bothered, and excited by it all. And the clear inability for collective political or social intelligence to respond to these threats, you know, is also painfully observable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can go to Geneva or South America or, you know, anywhere you want to go and have a conference, but you know,
nobody's doing nothing.
But no one can. Nobody can do anything. I mean, you know, powerful people, you know, like Vladimir Putin, you know, he doesn't appear to be altruistically oriented toward education, toward distribution of wealth, toward dignifying his people. He's just a criminal and a thief. But so's Obama. You know, so's the president of France and Israel and the Middle East. All the presidents are, what are they? I mean, the Pope is a thief, a criminal and a thief. The Pope doesn't have the guts to say, hey, you know what? Someone ought to take Monsanto to task. You never hear the Pope, you know, talking about the profound illness of the corporatocracy, which is going to destroy everyone. He doesn't have the balls to do it. I mean, you know, the gay issue, contraception issue, those things mean nothing. Those are trivial pursuits. And that's what the Catholic Church gets excited about. That's what all the bishops and the cardinals get excited about, is same-sex marriage not being recognized by Jesus, or contraception is bad. That's what bothers them? What, are they crazy? It's like they're still living in the, you know, 1500s.
I know, it's medieval.
They're completely medieval. The church is medieval. But, you know, you can go to more contemporary leaders, let's say like the Dalai Lama, but he's medieval too. You know, he's the master of nonviolent appeasement. While the Chinese prod his monks with, you know, cattle devices. And the sorrow is so unbearable that, you know, quite a number of them self-immolate.
Can we go back to that other concept?
Oh, the happy side of things?
Yeah. It's kind of a downer. Harsh in my groove here, even though I brought it up, I think.
Yeah, really. Well, if you bring it up, you know, we'll just fucking launch into it no matter what it is. Oh, you mean transcendent bliss? Is that what you were talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, whatever's happening or not happening to the species at large happens to be, you know, the will of Brahman, happens to be transcendent bliss. Even if it means we all sing Kumbaya with an incoming, you know, lethal comet. See, this is just an... Listen, this gets very intimate and very challenging when we look at the stupendous present nature of consciousness and the identification that we can't help but have when it comes to the hegemony of our creaturehood. You are really, really interested in your next breath. You may not be consciously so, but have someone put their hand firmly over your nose and mouth and watch what you do. right? I mean, you will bite them and stomp the fucking living shit out of them if they try to interfere with your right to breathe. Then you'll call the police and say, "Oh, I just killed somebody. I'm really sorry. They put their hand over my mouth and I freaked out." Right? Yeah, we're very, very vulnerable when it comes to, you know, our biologic rhythms or our psychiatric or emotional rhythms or our personal space. You know, we are very deeply and understandably so.
I don't know. Have you ever been to talk to a South American? They get right up underneath you and start talking. Mm-hmm. And you're like, "Are you coming on to me or something?" But no, yeah, really. They're just getting close.
yeah, they get in close. Yeah, there's cultures like that where personal space is, you know, dealt with differently. Yeah. That's right. You know, these recurring themes that come out of the, you know, the post Yogananda yogic world, you know, you are not the body and you are not the mind, right? Mm-hmm. Are speaking directly to the profundity of identification with creaturehood, right? Identification with individuation, with the movement of thought and abstract universe creation, which is what mind is. Mind is just a simple word for the profundity of abstract universe creation, in which one places oneself as an individuated creature. Go figure. You know, when we go in search of something as lofty as self-realization, you know, usually it's to mitigate the nuisance of the creature, right? To mitigate the nuisance of identification and apprehension and fear and self-loathing. We can't stand it anymore. So enlightenment becomes, hopefully it becomes a remedy for all that. But as we take it a little deeper, a little more seriously, and we see that there's something else at stake rather than a hoped for pleasure, right? Then we have to recommit. You could say along this path, whatever the path is, whether you like to call it a Dzogchen path or a Kashmiri Shaivistic path or a Yoga of Radiant Present path or a recovery path with, you know, traveling lighter at the tail end, you're going to be faced with the challenge to recommit. Because what motivated you yesterday will no longer motivate you today.
Yeah, I think I read that early on in the Ram Dass book about meditation.
Yeah, well, if Ram Dass said it, it can't be true.
That was a long time ago, I think.
Yeah. Right.
And then you don't know why you're doing it, you just are.
You don't really know why you're doing anything.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, reaching for a slice of rye bread to put some mayonnaise on it. It's like, whoa.
Yeah, because they don't really go together culturally, do they? I mean.
Yeah, that's good. I think Fluffernutter is better with rye bread.
Ew. I always like that one Woody Allen movie where he's trying to find a remedy to his existential panic. So he starts exploring other religions. And he entertains being a Catholic, and he comes home with, like, white bread. And and a big crucifix. And,
yeah. Yeah.
But sentence in the Marx Brothers movie at the end.
That was always the place to find it. Via duck, via not a chicken. You know, the miracle that precedes the urgency of wanting happens to be, you know, the portal or the revelation of the Brahmanic field. We think that we should respond to wanting with some kind of object or subject or experience or takeaway. It doesn't dawn on us that the profundity, the genesis of wanting itself, is the Brahmanic field. So we turn, in a manner of speaking, we turn away from the primacy that we already are, and then try to fulfill an imaginary conviction of insufficiency. And this is not a trivial knot. I mean, you can have a million conversations with very bright, high IQ, well-educated, sincere people, and they will wear you out with the insistence that they are a creature that's seeking for a remedy to they know not what. And if you try to assist them, suggest to them that the wanting itself is the fact of Brahman, they will simply not understand it. They will refuse it. They'll turn away from it so that they can continue the the angelic or hell realm, the angelic field or hell realm of seeking itself, thinking that they're going to place themselves in an optimal condition in a future that they don't actually possess.
So the wanting and the longing is the remedy.
The wanting and the longing is the truth. And the, what did Jesus say? The truth and the being and the what? Something like that, right?
The truth and the being and the what?
I thought there was a tautology that was attributed to Jesus, right?
I'll look it up.
It's good to have a scribe in the middle of a conversation. Yeah, just imagine if you had to run off to the library and grab your Encyclopedia Britannica instead of having...
I am the light and the something and the something. Starts with light.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
The light,
yeah.
And the truth and the...
Yeah, then the way, right?
The light.
Yeah, that's it.
The light, the truth,
the
way.
Yeah.
Sweet. So that's what suffering is. Suffering and wanting is the light and the truth and the way. I mean, isn't that the discovery? When you're sitting in a room staring, right? The reason you're sitting there staring is because you're immeasurably happy. You have discovered that your present experience is the light, is the truth, is the way. And you've got nothing better to do with your time than to sit around and stare at shit. You know, but I wouldn't necessarily suggest you go to your local pastor and say, you know, Father O'Donnell, Father, I am the light and the truth and the way. You know, I just sit around and stare. I mean, he'll make you do 35 Hail Marys and, you know, come back next week. Nobody in the church or the temple or the mosque or the zendo actually wants you to succeed. That was reserved for the long deceased founder. I mean, if you go to an Ekinkar meeting, not that I'm encouraging it, and chant and chant Hugh, because they love to chant Hugh. I don't know who Hugh is. I mean, is it Huey Lewis? Or is it, or was there some creature from the Disney Channel named Hugh? I'm not quite sure.
One of
sure.
the ducks, I think.
It had to be one of the ducks, I thought.
Huey,
yeah.
Dewey, and Louie.
Huey, Dewey, and Louie. I think that's who they're chanting to, is Huey.
It's
they just shortened it.
At the Mind, Body, Spirit, whatever conference.
Yeah.
That guy, I crossed his path just randomly, and he was like cueing at me, showing me all this, and I'm like yeah. pretending to listen real intently, and he's cueing. Yeah. I'm like, oh, let me try, and I'm cueing. And when I walked away, I'm like, it was so funny. It was, I was like, oh, this totally hungry ghost. Like, now they're just going, ooh.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they don't know what to do with themselves, so that when they come near you, they just start going, hue, hue, hue. It's like, that's the best pickup line they've got. Hue, hue. Anyway, if you go to an Ekinkar meeting and you say, so, like, what's the path of attainment here? Well, they'll all freak out because the only one that's entitled to attain is the living Ekmaster. That means that, you know, 50,000, 500,000 people chanting Hugh have all agreed to be second rate. The only one entitled to get the goodies of the highest that you can get is the founder, more or less long deceased. At least with the Ekinkar people, there is a living Ekmaster.
With most Christians, you don't put out that you have, you know, the Jesus' message was, you're no different than me, and you've got everything you need to just see it what I see it. They don't get that.
It's not strongly reinforced during the passages that you go through in the Catholic Church, right?
Hell no.
No. They don't sit there at the...
Not strongly reinforced. You tell them that you're, you know, Jesus was the same as you.
Yeah.
They'll ride you right out of there.
If you're lucky, they'll ride you right out without first tar and feathering you.
Yep.
No, you'd be lucky if they just chased you out. So this is kind of a dilemma for, you know, the run-of-the-mill primate who's actually interested in direct experience. Because if the only person entitled to have and profess direct experience is the deceased founder, well, then you are second rate. You don't belong there. It'd be interesting to see, you know. I don't know. Maybe it's already the case that more and more people are being disenfranchised with the violation of organized religion and pursuing their own, you know, beatitude. I mean, I got, you know, an invitation from this lovely woman somewhere in Philadelphia that sponsors crystal singing bowl, you know, full moon celebrations or something. It was really hysterical. I mean, from the first word till the last word, she was using all of this bizarre astrological new age Chiron based language to seduce you into coming to hear the harmonically tuned crystal bowls from wherever, you know. It was just a hoot to listen to the, what would you call them, nouns, verbs, adverbs, adjectives, and other elements of language that were all about being as high as you could possibly be under the influence of these divine musical instruments. And that whole New Age urgency, You can tell is, you know, people wanting to take their divinity into their own hands. Because they're certainly not getting it from the temple or the mosque or the church or the Zendo or the, you know, yoga master.
Well, it's kind of sad, though. It's like, trying to take it into your own hands, but you need all this shit. You need special stuff. You gotta have the stuff, and you gotta have like you know, other people that offer you stuff and techniques and all the rest of this horseshit. And it's way removed from just this.
Yes, that's right. The insistence upon and the reliance upon external accoutrements for high spiritual experience is pedestrian. Go ahead.
It can be fun. You know, tinfoil hats and furbas were great fun.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But to desperately grasp onto that stuff is just taking yourself down the rabbit hole that'll never get you anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, Chiron can piss off. I would rather just sit around and stare. Yeah, you don't need accoutrements or externalized excitations to revel in your already strange nature. And the dependency on these things would likely to naturally decline as one discovered how much of the light and the truth and the way they are. And why not look right into the belly of the beast, right into the suffering, right into the frustration and the restlessness, to see that that is Brahmanically radiant. The collapse of time, the collapse of becoming, can be very useful.
Very useful in a totally non-useful kind of way.
Yep. Yes, it's irrational that way. Very useful in a non-useful kind of way.
It's not useful in the way I'm going to do this because it's going to get me that. It's seemingly useful. It's useful just because it's restful. Or just here in a way that other stuff isn't. Or other stuff is. I'm not making any sense.
Well, it makes sense. Yeah, I mean, everything can be instantaneously relativistic with no problem, and everything can be curiously non-relativistic, you know, as a unicity of being. And it's both. It's not one to the exclusion of the other. It's not like you are sacred prior to being a self-loathing idiot. You are sacred as a self-loathing idiot. Oh, it never dawned on me that being a self-loathing idiot was actually sacred. Oh my.
I think you should proclaim the news to the needy, self-loathing idiot horde. Proclaim the good news.
Really? Yeah, I'm going to find a soapbox, and I think I'll go out to Central Park in Doylestown and share the news with everybody.
They'll be flocking to you, Jeff.
Oh, yeah. First the pigeons. hey, that guy's surrounded by pigeons.
You can put that in your creating community ad. Are you a self-loathing idiot?
Really?
Well, you're sacred.
Yeah, really. Yeah, we'll charge you $20 to find out. Let's face it, you know, the more profoundly you begin to stray from the conditioning, right, of conventional muggle consciousness, you begin to occupy, I don't know, your own world. You begin to occupy a quality of sensation and insight and tingle, which is just not articulated in the common vocabulary of most muggles. And yeah, it can be lonely, it can be disorienting. One might even go to see a counselor, a psychiatrist, take medication just to come back to mugglehood. It won't work, but you know, you might do that. If you didn't have some kind of, let's say, support mechanism, and you were nervous because you were starting to live in a dream-like apparitional world where you found yourself unwholesomely happy too much of the day, you might seek medical intervention. But if you're lucky enough to have a couple of friends that support and encourage staring off into space, then it maybe make it a little easier. Yeah, you know, I know a lot of people that are interested in this kind of stuff. And, you know, here we are on a Tuesday evening and there's, right, four of us kicking it around.
Well, it can't be us, right? So.
Yeah.
The few, the proud, the miserable.
The few, the proud, the miserable, yeah. I like it. Makes perfect sense. This is so antithetical to everything that we've used to measure ourselves against. We're so busy constructing a imaginary, arbitrary universe of meaning and justification, of assessment and measure, based loosely on creature comforts or financial security or wellness or mitigating loneliness or insecurities of some kind. I mean, really.
Or even being good, like finding meaning in life. Like a lot of people just say, they're just good.
Yep.
And I don't have an ounce of like reach out and be good anymore left, it seems.
Yeah, you're finally no good.
I used to make sure that I showed up and did like the charity Christmas stuff. At the very least, just to save face so I looked good.
Whether
I wanted to or not, and now I just can't make myself do it.
Yeah, at best you were an altruistic poser But now even that's gone.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah.
Now you're bad to the bone.
Bad to the bone.
Can't you just hear them saying, well, what if everybody in the world saw it this way? Nobody would help anybody.
Nobody would need to.
Yeah.
You know, it just might be that revelation operates, you know, truly on its own terms, right? On it, truly transhuman terms. And so this altruistic interest that we may harbor for the world to get along better with itself in a more sustaining, humane, dignifying, celebratory manner is just not what this life form is destined to do. It may just not be what this form of curious, you know, life conundrum is capable of doing. So, you know, get your fair share of bliss and liberation as and while you can. And if it turns out that you're a source of comfort or humor, camaraderie and intelligence for someone else, well, that's great. You know, that's cool. That's real nice. But there's no rule that suggests that, you know, these kinds of penetrations of the mystery and misery of consciousness should turn out to have some kind of altruistic utility for the species at large. I mean, Jesus hasn't made much of a dent, nor Buddha, nor Muhammad, nor Krishna, nor Krishna Das, nor Rumi, or Bilbo Baggins, or Gandalf, or Carlos Castaneda, or Terence McKenna. So, you know, it's like you find the tribal pals that somehow resonate with your peculiar form of strangeness, and you take up residence in your own revelatory nature, you know, with as much glee as you've got. The world, if there were one, kind of takes care of itself, always has.
Coming from a kind of a 12-step background, and then finding Byron Katie that kind of really resonated with that.
Yeah.
It was shocking when I first sat with Peter and, you know, kind of got the gist of what you're pointing to, that there's not an ethical moral component to this, and yet it makes so much sense when I pause and just look at it. But it's like that in itself kind of rocked my whole compass.
Sure.
You know, yes. You're raised Catholic, and it's if you're just good enough, you know, you do enough good, and good deeds will get you to heaven.
Sure, that and a numerous other myths punctuate the confounding nature of primate experience.
You know, they could be all right and I could be going to hell, but I really don't give a shit because the other was just so not working because it wasn't honest. It was a manipulation all the
way. Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, anything that's imposed culturally or morally, behaviorally, fear of retribution, sin, abandonment, right, shunning, hell, it doesn't work. No fear-based consequence motivates very well.
Yep. I'll take honest greed any day.
Yeah.
Any day.
Sure.
These are all sounding like Gordon Gekko here.
That's right. I like it. Howard Rourke. Gordon Gekko. Right. Our faves.
I sort of feel like until I can transcend my karma, I better just, you know, stay on the up and up.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I know. It's funny. We are curiously superstitious when it comes to comeuppance. And, you know, I don't know to what degree negative consequences actually motivates our behavior. I just
don't
know.
Well, shame does not. They know that to be true.
Okay, shame doesn't work.
Shame does not work.
Fair enough. Yeah.
It just makes you feel worse, and then you overeat or you do drugs or whatever you don't want to do.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a more natural inclination, you know, the altruism just, if it's going to be there, it's going to be there spontaneously.
But yes, like, all does. I mean, all occurs spontaneously. The Koch brothers do what they do spontaneously, and who's the opposite of the Koch brothers? I don't know. Ben and Jerry. Ben and Jerry do what they do
Tom
spontaneously.
Of Maine. Oh, no, the guy who makes the shoes, Tom's shoes.
Yeah, really. You know.
Mother Teresa.
Mother Teresa. She was hell on wheels, they said.
Yeah.
My God, I used to want to be like her. It was like I had to be like that good.
She wasn't
That's
that
a
good.
Lot of pressure.
She just wasn't that good. I mean, she lived remarkably, right? Fearlessly. You know, in ways that few human beings could mimic. But who knows? I mean, she wasn't the most ideal saint the world had ever seen.
Well, she wasn't always very happy or joyful.
No.
She had a lot of doubt, I think, and
yeah. Yeah, no one alive or dead, you know, really had it together. There's no point in being like anyone alive or dead.
To thine own self be true.
Your own experience is sovereign. Your own experience is autonomous, is impersonal. You're the best puppet ever. It's never satisfying, really, to worship someone other than your own experience or try to be like someone else, because it interferes with the fact that you are autonomous and sovereign. And if we continue to deny the fact that we are autonomous and sovereign by worshiping others, we'll never be happy, because we become dependent, right, on an imaginary and idealized condition or satisfaction or validation. And that just doesn't work. You know, I mean, the smart guru says, leave me alone. Look after yourself. Enjoy yourself. Worship yourself. Right? Leave me alone.
Unless they need your money.
Well, this is the problem. You know, you look at Dafri John and others, you see, you know, a really tragic, predatory form of guruism. you know. Sit with me, gaze into my eyes, see the miracle of yourself through me. Like, you gotta be fucking kidding me. See the miracle of yourself through yourself. Leave me out of it. I mean, it's not to deny that resonance occurs, and resonances can be very powerful and very affectionate and very startling and upsetting, you know, and that's, you could say, part of the yogic culture as well. But you're on your own, and thankfully you're intelligent enough, beautiful enough, mysterious enough, and crazy enough to have all the resources you need. That's a big discovery, right? To see that everything you need, you're already made of.
Amen.
Amen.
Yep.
Yeah.
Me, it's almost through kind of the defeat of some of these other pursuits, even the defeat of pursuing resonance.
Sure.
It's through that utter defeat where time and time again you're just dumped back into your own life and your own misery. It's like,
yes,
every time that happens, it's just like another invitation to find it here.
Yes.
And if it weren't for those defeats, I guess the muscle that needs to get strengthened to say this is it. It is just me, and this is all I get. And take a look. Like, those utter failures are kind of what's inviting me to something other than, I guess I could say, guru addiction.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the collapse of. We imprint from infancy, right? We're designed biologically to imprint from infancy. And of course, the parents are also biologically designed, even as so-called adults, to imprint upon their offspring. So it is a mutual adoration built into the biorhythm, you know, of the replication of species. And so that tendency, that profound vehicle of imprinting, of course, is going to play its role in, let's just call it a search for enlightenment, right? And we have to go through it. We have to go through the fire. We have to see what it's made of. We have to see what's there for us and what's not there for us. Then slowly we mature.
And I'll be the first to sign up for a rockin' good time with the right group of people. I mean, I'll be there again, hands down, because it's just so much friggin' fun.
Yeah, that's right.
But I don't expect it to give me 100% what I seek. I don't expect what I used to expect.
Wow, that's right. You are already what you seek in its entirety. You are the profundity of this, you know, the shifting sands of miraculous being.
Yeah.
And that's what happens, I guess, on a maturing adventure of so-called unfolding. The profundity of imprinting, of codependence, of giving away one's power, of, you know, benefiting from externalized resonances, right? All funnels back into the immediacy of you.
And when you start to land there, that's it.
Yeah.
When you start to land there, that's as good as anything else you can sign up for or go and do, and it's as good as any of that shit.
When you land in yourself, the couch is your best friend. The collapse of becoming, the collapse of restlessness, the collapse of seeking, of ideation, right? The revelation of fractal sparkles punctuating every subtle nuance of your current experience is enough to keep you fascinated, nourished, damn near enlightened, if not enlightened itself. It's a weird texture. I mean, it's, you know, it is challenging to put words on it or words around it that, you know, aren't blatant lies. Of course, even though everything is a blatant lie. But this present experience that one is having is truly transcendent and comes from nowhere and resolves into nothing and is glorious on high as the light and the truth and the way. That's what Jesus had, the revelation that his own being was complete. And he was doing his best to share the freedom of it, right, with whomever had the good karma to hang out and sip a cup of wine with him before the great insults began. And I really don't know why. You know, Jesus as myth, right, as socio-psychotropic myth, had to be dealt with so violently when he was, you know, more or less a pretty chill, non-violent character. You know what I mean? Like, why did the enduring story of the life of Jesus, and we've seen these stories appear almost verbatim in other earlier cultures. You wonder why the archetype is that the non-violent awakener is dealt with in such a heavy-handed manner. What kind of hidden guilt or denial, or dismissal, or abnegation is lurking in the umwelt of the consciousness that the story of Jesus has to end in such a post-traumatic, stress-disorderly manner? Why couldn't everyone have just sat around, had a cup of wine, enjoyed some flowers, and after a long, simple life, he simply ascended? What's the deal with the spears and the crosses and the blood and the whipping? What was the point of all that, culturally or archetypally? One wonders.
It's a good backdrop for some pretty healthy Christian guilt.
Well, yeah, isn't it? It's a good backdrop to keep a good woman and a good man down. It's a sickness. It's like the whole archetypal consciousness of the church that should otherwise be dedicated for the betterment of all humanity is built on a horrible PTSD event which keeps a good man and a good woman and a good child down. It's just interesting. It doesn't compute somehow. I don't know what happened historically or otherwise, right? I'm neither a scholar nor a Christian. So whatever reflections I may have about it are, you know, they're just completely dismissive. I mean, dismissible. Because I'm no one. But I'm just curious from a, you know, an archetypal, exploratory point of view, why the story of Christ, which has been such a blatant influence over such a stupid species, went the way that it went. You know, or that some aspects of fundamentalist Islam are practiced the way that they're practiced. Where is the justification for these horrors of psychic incarceration, of mutilation? can someone please explain the utility, the archetypal utility of these, you know, ways of being?
Some sort of juxtaposition. I mean, I when I did that holotropic breath work, I didn't have any kind of big experience, but
yeah,
they would talk about you would have the experience where you were the, you know, you were the one violent, you know, committing violent experiences, and you were the ones experiencing it. So maybe there's something about that.
Yeah, yeah. I beats me. I don't know. I mean, I'm not naive to think that we're not capable of committing or certainly enduring all kinds of violation. Enough are occurring day in and day out on planet Earth, whether reported or otherwise. And so you wonder, it's like, what the fuck is built into the, you know, archetypal DNA of the species that it conjures a story or an event syndrome like the life of Jesus, and then turns that into a reigning psychology and a religiosity for some huge percentage of the species. Like, why do we believe the shit that we believe? And why do we hold these archetypical post-traumatic stress events as defining of our consciousness? It's a fair question.
People like Gandhi or Martin Luther King, they end up getting assassinated, and they're, you know, the embodiment of nonviolent.
Yeah, but Martin Luther King was quite violent in his personal life.
I know he cheated on his wife, but in his
womanizing.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not taking a moral position here. Gandhi was also very aggressive, right? Very aggressive. You could say very violent, deterministic in the way that he hung out. I mean, so was Mother Teresa, you know, if you knew people that worked with her. She was hell on wheels. She wasn't sitting around with her head bent, you know, and her hands in a prayer pose. She was kicking ass 24/7. For the sake of the people that I guess that, you know, she served. I mean, if you hear stories of Amici, the great hugging saint, she beat the shit out of everyone. I mean, all the you know, adult male and female women, men and women that hung out with her and were and are close with her in terms of, you know, handling her affairs and otherwise. I mean, they've all been slapped around like nobody's business. Some of them have gone public, you know, with just how insane the cult of Amici is. And of course, you know, like any of these cults, once you turn the tides on the worshipful founder, you're ostracized and shunned and made to be small. It happened to Yogi Amrit Desai after word of his extramarital affairs came out, and then all of the denial and suppression that had accompanied those events. Right? So, I mean, no matter where you look, you're just going to find the seedy side of us. The seedy side of us. Oh, well.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, what are you going to do? Yeah. Really. I think I'll have the pork lo mein and the shrimp egg roll.
Sounds good.
I know.
I went to the Mongolian Grill for dinner tonight.
Nice.
And you start out, there's this monster sort of like, it's sort of like a salad bar, but it starts out with raw meat.
Uh-huh.
Put it in a bowl, and then you, like, progress on your way down this huge line of food and spices and...
Yeah.
And various and sundry things, and then at the end, you pick out your sauce, and then you hand the bowl over to them, and then you pick out, like, any, like, post-cooked toppings, and they, like, cook it all up. It's like a, sort of like a stir-fry where you pick out all the stuff.
Oh, gosh. Nice.
It was delicious. I did Thai peanut sauce, and I topped it with cilantro, peanuts. It was very good.
Who gives a shit about enlightenment at the Mongolian Grill?
Yeah.
I think Francine's coming back. She heard of that.
Really? Did somebody say Mongolian Grill? Are you fuckers? Are you fuckers done talking about enlightenment? We can get onto the Mongolian Grill. God, I was snoozing there for a while, but now I'm back.
I claimed I skipped dinner. I only skipped dinner with the crew. I just had dinner myself, and it was.
We know that you're. What your true interests are.
Yep.
Well, these are kind of, for me, funny but pleasing conversations. The emphasis need not be on what's wrong with anybody or how to outwit the apparent crappiness of your life so that you can be an enjoyer of liberation. You know, say, once there's a certain kind of, let's just say, found relaxation, that your own presence is the truth and the light and the way, then I think we just naturally place fewer demands on ourselves to try to perfect some kind of idealized experience. And in that relaxation, which is automatically self-transmutative, something kind of lovely just shows up. And it's not the result of, a heated attack or a heated aspiration. It's like, oh, wow, I can be kind of ordinary. Good luck not being that. And kind of pedestrian, good luck not being that. And still, I can discover a texture and a tickle and a joy, which is me, which happens to be me. I know it's not that valuable for the rest of the world, but it's the best we can do, right?
Works for me.
Well, it's 9:00. I guess that means it's time to stop.
Are we going to sing a song we sing at the end now?
Is there a song? Does someone have a song we can sing? I'd like. Is there like an old romper room tune?
Yeah. Some sort of romper room tune.
Or maybe something that Thich Nhat Hanh sings. We can sing that in his honor.
Howdy Doody time. Or...
Howdy Doody's good.
Maybe we should all hue.
U-M-I-C. See you real soon. K-E-Y. Why? Because we love you. M-O-U-S-E. That'll do it. Well, we'll see you all on Thursday, maybe.
Hey, Sarah.
Okay.
Good night.
All right.
Bye.
Bye, guys.